KPCW News time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. So this is my first opportunity to talk to Cedric Haynes, who's going to give us the weather. Good morning, Cedric.
Good morning. I appreciate you having me on, and I'm glad to get a chance to talk to you this morning. Let's talk about that forecast here as we go throughout the rest of today. Of course, in Park City, we're looking at, again, some of that smoky haze, the sunshine out there. But the good news is we think that the haze will be, I will call it less thick than it has been the past couple of days. So there's a little silver lining there, but temperatures are going to be a big deal. They're going to warm up into the low to mid 90s in Park City. Now in the Heber Valley, we're going to be seeing those temperatures getting right around 100 degrees or a little higher with that smoke and haze out there. So yeah, it's going to be a hot one, and the air quality not so good again for us today. Now, as we go into the weekend, we'll see some small subtle changes showing up there. We'll call it partly sunny skies. Now it's going to stay hot with those temperatures in the 90s to near 100 degrees, but we're going to start to introduce a little monsoonal moisture. So that could mean we could see a couple of isolated showers and storms developing on your Saturday and Sunday. Now, of course, we're not expecting a washout. No need to really cancel your outdoor plans if you're going to be doing any recreating, but just know that there will be a few of those pop-up showers and storms, especially, I think, in the late afternoon and the early evening hours moving from south to north. So we'll get that in the forecast there for you. Some of these storms, of course, could produce some gusty winds, also some heavy downpours, but also a little lightning, and that's a problem because with it being so dry, that could lead to some of those isolated fires getting started. And with the erratic winds of the outflow boundaries, that could lead to those spreading quickly. So just kind of be aware of that, and be aware that it is going to be one of those days you're going to want to check the radar before you head outside for any of your outdoor plans. But the good news is the heat, the rain chances will kind of stick around. And I think the valley areas, and then temperatures dropping into the 80s across the north.
Okay, Cedric, thanks for spending time with us this morning. Yeah.
No problem. Thank you for having me, and ever safe weekend, and stay hydrated.
This is Roger Goldman. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Coming up, I'll be speaking with Summit County Fair Manager Tyler Orgel about all that's going to be happening at the fair. Then we're going to speak with U.S. Paralympic fencer Garrett Schoonover about his upcoming trip to the Paris Paralympics. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with the Utah Planned Parenthood CEO, Kat Boyd. We're going to be talking about yesterday's Supreme Court decision on Utah's abortion laws. Stay tuned. Former Olympic Nordic skier Brett Camerata has been arrested and is being held without bail after violating a protective order. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
Camerata's latest arrest comes after he was charged with assault related to domestic violence this spring. In June, Camerata made a plea in abeyance agreement for the charge of assault with injury. Under the terms of the agreement, Camerata's plea of no contest to the charge would be held in abeyance for a year and a half. That means if, over 18 months, he demonstrated good behavior, broke no laws, and underwent a domestic violence evaluation, the charge would be dismissed. But breaking the terms of the agreement sends him back to court, and he can be sentenced for the original crime. Camerata violated a protective order that forbade him from stalking, harassing, or threatening the person who filed it. A charging document says he is subject to an enhanced penalty based on the plea in abeyance. He is being held without bail in the Summit County Jail. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
A 26-year-old man has been charged for allegedly trying to open an airplane's door mid-flight, forcing the plane to make an emergency landing in Salt Lake City. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
According to court documents, Eric Nicholas Gapko of New Jersey engaged in disruptive and life-threatening behavior on a July 18th American Airlines flight from Seattle to Dallas. Prosecutors say Gapko assaulted and intimidated the flight crew and attempted to open exterior doors multiple times while the plane was in the air. Court documents say he locked himself in the lavatory, illegally vaped on the plane, and was loud and repeatedly bothered other passengers. The flight crew and other passengers were forced to restrain Gapko, securing his feet and hands during the flight. The plane diverted to Utah, and the New Jersey man was arrested at the Salt Lake City International Airport. While detained, Gapko spit on a police officer and broke the glass in his jail cell. Wednesday, a federal grand jury charged Gapko for interfering with a flight crew and attempting to damage an aircraft. He'll be in federal court Thursday in Salt Lake City. Along with the federal charges, Gapko is facing two felonies and a misdemeanor for his behavior while in Salt Lake City police custody. If convicted, he could face several years in prison. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
The landscapers fined for storing equipment at their Highland Estates home have appealed the penalty in district court. KPCW's Connor Thomas has the latest.
Dulio Fragapane and Melissa De La Rocca incurred a $164,000 fine in June after failing to comply with county code enforcement. Last year, neighbors in Highland Estates had called Summit County about the couple's home on Highland Drive, where they were storing equipment for their landscaping business. They weren't permitted to operate a business on the property, and although they applied for a permit, they never obtained one, and eventually received a $500 penalty June 20th for every day they'd failed to remove the equipment since July 28th of 2023. This year, on July 29th, Fragapane appealed that fine. Through attorney Brian Weber, he's asking Third District Court to waive it. The landscaper says he wasn't given proper notice of his June 20th hearing with an administrative law judge, and when he showed up anyway, he was denied due process. Fragapane says he was not allowed to present evidence in his defense. His complaint also states that when the county first cited him last year, he was afforded two options.
You move everything out or you apply for a permit. And that's what we did right away.
The planning department denied their permit application earlier this year. The complaint alleges county code enforcers told Fragapane he could simply tell the judge his permit was denied and that the judge would afford him some time to remove the landscaping equipment. Instead, he was fined, and in a recording of the hearing obtained by KPCW, through a public records request, Fragapane is heard telling the judge it could bankrupt him. He and De La Rocca removed their equipment shortly after that hearing. They haven't had to pay the fine yet. Since filing the appeal, their attorney has met with county staff to negotiate a reduced fine. Peter Barnes, who became the county's planning director after the landscapers were fined, declined to comment, citing those ongoing talks. Fragapane says code enforcement continues to visit his home to ensure they're keeping it clear. He says they've taken issue with paving materials he claims are for his own driveway and with the number of trucks parked there. Summit County has not filed a response to the landscaper's appeal as of Thursday. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Arts Festival is far from the only game in town this weekend. Tomorrow marks the opening of the Summit County Fair. Here to share details, we have Fair Manager Tyler Orgel and Fair Administrator Kate McChesney. Good morning. Thanks for being here, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with the basics. Where is the fair held, and how long is it going to be in town?
So the fair is out at the Summit County Fairgrounds. It's going to be, we kick off this weekend on the 3rd with our Demolition Derby, and it runs through the following weekend with our PRCA Rodeo. And the weekend after that, we've got have Rodney Adkins in concert on the 17th, so we're excited about that. So we've got 2 weeks full of events coming up.
Okay. Can you share a little bit about the history of the fair? How long has it been held? Is it always, I assume it's always been at the fairgrounds because that's why they're called the fairgrounds.
Yeah, for sure. I believe that we had the Centennial Fair in 2009, so we're well over 100 years here, and so it's been around for quite a while. So it's been at the fairgrounds. We're making some improvements right now with some different construction projects, and so the fair is going to look different this year. It's actually going to be moved a little bit on the property, which we're excited about. It's all coming together, so it's going to be great.
I love that phrase, it's all coming together. That suggests that there's been a whole lot of activity in the last few days, and somehow I think you haven't gotten much sleep.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Demolition Derby. Always a hit. Is it sold out?
Yes, it's okay. Sold out, yep.
So,
wait, though, there is something very exciting happening, though, with the Demolition Derby this year. We actually have a big screen coming, so this coming Saturday night, if you didn't get tickets, you can still come enjoy all the food and all the entertainment and activities that we have going on, because there will be a big screen, so you can still come with your family and watch the show and hear it, but you won't actually be in the arena.
Okay, so let's talk about the Demolition Derby. How many vehicles participate in it typically?
We see, it just kind of depends on the year. Some years we have 30, like last year we had 60. So it just kind of, varies back and forth depending on the year and how the contestants pan out in other competitions.
And is this kind of like a grown-up Pinewood Derby in the sense that we have, backyard mechanics trying to engineer wrecks to run long enough to be in the Demolition Derby? Is that how this works?
Oh, it's a shady tree mechanic specialty, absolutely. But the cool thing is there's actually kids now that are competing. And we also have, during one of our little halftime shows, we have a little, what are they?
The Power Wheels.
Power
Derby.
Wheels. Yeah. Power Wheels Derby. So probably like 30 or 40 kids and their souped up Power Wheels come in and then they do a total crash. And it's an amazing event.
I don't want to spend too long on this, but the technique of a good Demolition Derby person, do they try to run backwards so they don't smash the radiators? Is that sort of the key to winning this thing?
Yep, protect the engine, yep, and your wheels. Yeah, that way you can keep going.
And how long does it usually take before we only have one winner left?
It just depends on the heat, but a lot of them will last, a couple minutes.
Are there multiple heats?
Multiple heats.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So, why is this such a compelling event? I mean, you can't take your eyes off it. It always sells out. What is there a 12-year-old buried in each of us that wants us to see these cars slamming into each other?
Everybody yes. thinks they want to be a Derby driver until they watch, and then they say, "Oh, okay, this might be better just sitting on the sidelines." But it is. It's a high competition. These people put their heart and soul into it, and they're risking their lives ultimately to get in the car. So yeah, it's an edge of your seat competition.
Okay. How do you get the competitors? Is there just an entry process?
Yeah, we have entries that people can sign up online, but our event promoters that help with the event, they really do a lot of groundwork and getting a lot of cars out, and that's how we recruit a lot of the contestants.
Well, I don't plan on entering next year because I'm like Kate, I think I want to do it, but would never actually get behind the wheel.
No.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the other events that are going to be happening at the fair. What is the Junior Buckaroo Rodeo?
Little Buckaroo.
Yeah, Little Buckaroo Rodeo. So that's an event for all kids under the age of 18 where they can come and ride a sheep, a calf, a steer, little mini bucking ponies, mini bucking bulls. So there's a lot of different events that way. And then there's also another night of just timed events where we do a lot of barrels, racing, keyhole. So it's based around the kids. It's a great opportunity for them to come out and compete in these events, and it's a lot of fun.
And is this something that they would have signed up for already, or is it open entry? How does it work?
They can still sign up. They have until Monday night to get signed up, so they still have a couple more days.
And is it scary? I mean, obviously, real rodeos, grown-up rodeos scare the daylights out of me. Are the kids' events, I assume they're nowhere near as scary as the real ones.
No, they're pretty good. They're not too bad. So putting a little four-year-old on a sheep, they have a great time, yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I think if you ask the little four-year-old, it might be a different answer.
Is that what those tears mean? Yeah, I mean, is that what the crying is?
The parent thinks it's fantastic because they want video and pictures, but the four-year-old might not necessarily agree. But we get probably 60 to 70 youth just riding mutton, which is the sheep, and then from there it'll kind of trickle off as the kids get older. They realize that maybe this isn't the best event for them, but we still get a great showing. We probably have 130 kids over the course of Wednesday night.
That's one night, right?
That's just going to be, and that's what we call our main event night. And then Thursday night is timed events. So these are the best of the best kids in Summit County that are riding what would be a typical rodeo. So you've got barrel riders, you've got timed events, so these are the best of the best. And a lot of these kids will go on, as we've heard, into a real PRC rodeo.
And how old are the kids who are participating in those sort of more real, for lack of a better term, events?
Anywhere between 5 and 17 years old.
Okay. And some of these are actually going to go on to a PRCA level rodeo?
We have had definitely children from a lot of Utah, including Summit County, that have gone on to PRCA.
And that, of course, leads us into the PRCA rodeo. When is that going to be?
That's going to be next Friday and Saturday, so the 9th and the 10th.
And for those who don't know those initials, what is PRCA?
Professional Rodeo and Cowboy Association.
Oh, okay, so there's a circuit, I take it, of my knowledge of rodeo comes from watching Yellowstone, but there's a circuit of these...
You're not alone.
of these rodeo events that this is part of, your PRCA event is part of that circuit?
Yep, we're affiliated with the circuit, and then it all culminates in December at the National Finals Rodeo, where the people who've went out and won the most go and compete for the world title.
And for those of our listeners whose knowledge is as limited as mine, what are the events in a PRCA rodeo?
So you've got saddle bronc riding, you've got bareback bronc riding, you've got the bucking bulls, and then on the timed event side of things, you've got calf tying, you've got team roping, steer wrestling. Those are, the real cowboys, the ones that are willing to jump off a running animal and
then
wrestle
another
one.
For the women's event, we have barrel racing.
Yeah,
what is barrel racing?
Barrel is when the gal is on the horse and they have to do a certain pattern around three different barrels in a very short period of time without having any infractions. So it's a very fast-paced, that the gal and their horse are very in tune for that particular event.
It would be interesting to talk to one of these people who pursued professional rodeo as a career. And I take it is a career. These people do this more.
They travel the country. And they have their circuits that they go to, and so we are thankful to be, right smack in the middle of the country, so we get a great turnout.
And the word P obviously implies professional, which means money. Are there purses that are offered for a PRCA event? Where does the money for that come from?
So yeah, that comes from our budget. We put into the purse, we put $55,000 in addition to what the PRCA offers for the purse. So it's a pretty decent amount of money.
And again, this may be not something you have your hands on, but what does a prize, you know, obviously we're used to thinking about professional golfers who make a gazillion dollars for finishing first or second. Somehow I don't think this is quite that, but what would a barrel racing winner, for example, what would be the purse for a barrel racing winner typically?
About $5,000.
So it's real money.
Yeah.
It is real money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And again, that I assume that one's not sold out yet?
Nope, not. Okay. We still have tickets available for that.
Okay. Yep. The Miss Summit County Pageant, what's that?
Yeah, so that actually happened last night. We crowned a new queen where girls come in and compete in a variety of different competitions, such as, casual wear, fitness, evening gown.
Talent. Interview process.
Yeah.
This is a tradition,
absolutely.
We need
royalty.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so last night we had an amazing event that started at 7 o'clock at the North Summit High School, and we crowned a queen and a first attendant and a second attendant and a third attendant, and all these great ladies will now support us during the entire fair, helping us with all the activities. We also have a royalty for our rodeo, so we actually have a horse royalty as well as a Summit County Fair royalty. So we've got lots of royalty happening.
Is the horse royalty a horse or a person?
It's a person who competes in these amazing events with their horse.
Okay.
And so, yes.
Now, does this feed into the Miss America pageant? Is this part of that circuit, or where does it go anywhere?
No, we're not affiliated with the Miss America.
Okay. All right. So what are the other events that I've not asked you about that you'd want our listeners to hear about?
So as far as just, the carnival will kick off. So on Wednesday when we have the Little Buckaroo, that'll kick off this afternoon. And then as well, the carnival is starting to set up. And so at 5 o'clock on Wednesday. So all the kids really need to come out because all those events are kind of free to attend. If you want to get on the carnival ride, you'll pay. But if you want to get in the competition, you'll pay a little bit. But as well, the livestock starts getting loaded in. So we have a huge livestock sale that happens in Summit County, which supports the 4-H children. Then on top of that, in our Ledges event building, we have our fine arts competition, our home arts, we have 4-H arts. So there's a ton. And on top of that, fair food. So
I was gonna ask you about fair food.
Oh, there's
food.
Fair food.
I mean, it's not a fair without funnel cake, I assume.
That is correct.
Okay, and what do you have a bunch of food trucks? What will be there?
We have corn dogs and fried Oreos and funnel cakes and french fries and pizza.
And scone dots.
Scone dots.
Yeah, no, fair food. When I hear fair food, I think of fried, generally frying things that you would not normally fry, like Oreos.
Correct. Treat yourself. We also have a beer garden that'll happen this coming Saturday night as well as next Friday and Saturday. So we have all the offerings.
So are there, you mentioned 4-H, are there some of the traditional 4-H competitions like, who's got the prettiest sheep or anything like that?
Exactly. So there's a sheep showing, there's a poultry showing, there's a rabbit showing.
With pigs and
pigs
steers.
Pigs and cows.
Yep.
Yes. So even to come and look in our livestock arena, you'll be able to come and see all the animals that have been entered into the for the weekend.
And just to sort of make, let's review what opens when. Obviously tonight we talked about the Demolition Derby, the fairgrounds will be open, the food will be there as of tonight.
Correct.
When does the carnival will not open tonight yet?
Everything else, after Saturday night, everything else really comes to light next Wednesday.
Okay. And runs for about 10 days after that?
It'll run through Saturday with the end of the PRCA rodeo. Then we take a nice, well-needed break. And then we'll do a finale concert on the 17th with Rodney Atkins.
Okay.
And those tickets are only $15. So that is an amazing concert to come out to in beautiful scenic Colville.
And you mentioned a livestock auction. Who buys these animals? Tell me about what kind of commerce is going on there.
Yeah, so we've got amazing businesses throughout the county that come out and support these kids that are purchasing these animals, as well as amazing individuals just from the community. The kids really receive a lot of support. last year, I think we had about 120 exhibitors, roughly, give or take 10, and they raised about $700,000 in sales.
Okay. If people want to know more about the fair, can you tell us the website?
Yeah, summitcountyfair.org.
Okay, anything else you want to add before we go?
No, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for being here this morning. We'll be right back after this. Well, Wasatch County Senior Center members have just completed the world's largest jigsaw puzzle. KPCW's Christine Weller reports their work is now on display at the Wasatch County Fair.
Candy Bonner, activity coordinator for the Wasatch County Senior Center, says it all started after she saw Utah's Springville Senior Center build the puzzle piece by piece. She knew the around 500 Wasatch County Senior Center members would enjoy the task. They asked, Springville answered.
We went down in March and actually took this puzzle apart, and it took four of us over 4 hours.
Utah-based company Dowdle created the puzzle. Titled What a Wonderful World, it features a map and scenes from across the globe. It's the world's largest commercially available jigsaw puzzle with 60,000 pieces, measuring 8 feet by 29 feet. The puzzle comes with 60 1,000-piece puzzles that can be assembled separately and then connected to create one huge puzzle. It retails for $750. The puzzle was set out in the Wasatch Center's entryway in March. The last piece was placed in July. Bonner said it likely took more than 1,000 hours to complete, with some members plugging away for 8 hours a day. Laurel and Joe Rail from Midway were dedicated to putting the puzzle together. Laurel Rail said they went to the center every day before and after lunch and likely finished 10 of the 60 portions of the puzzle on their own.
I did all of the people and the names of the places and the animals and the flags. And I think my favorite one was the White House. It had about 50 flags on it.
Rail said she enjoyed working on the puzzle because it was a challenge and fostered community. Dixie Baker worked on the puzzle 3 times a week with the Rails. She said Laurel Rail worked really well on the puzzle, even when it was upside down for her. Baker said the puzzle was a great escape from chores at home. She also enjoyed the Easter eggs along the way. Each of the 60 1,000-piece sections had an American flag and a reference to Utah.
Then it was exciting to see what kinds of landmarks were in these puzzles. It might be Bryce Canyon next to the Vatican, you know, or something. But he keeps that Utah theme through that. And it was just the camaraderie we had, got to make new friends, and it was just fun.
While Rail is sad to see the puzzle go, Bonner said the center found a family who's up for the challenge. There's just one requirement. The next in line have to disassemble it and come and get it. The senior center wants to make it a tradition to showcase a large puzzle at the fair each year. Bonner already has a lead on a new 50,000-piece work before this year's Wasatch County Fair comes to a close. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
All eyes have been glued to their television sets this week to watch the Paris Olympics. But the Paralympics will be coming up right after that. Here to talk about his road to the Paralympics is fencer Garrett Schoonover. Good morning, Garrett. Thanks for joining us.
Good. Oh, good morning, Roger. How are you this morning?
I am well, sir. So, Garrett, tell us a little bit about when do you head to Paris and when do the Paralympics start?
So we are leaving on the 25th. A lot of teammates are flying through Atlanta. There's a good, healthy sum of us flying here from Salt Lake. Opening ceremonies are on the 28th. The day before, we're supposed to get all of our Team USA gear so we can be all in uniform like you saw at the opening ceremonies.
And how many athletes will participate? Do you know how many athletes participate in the Paralympic Games overall?
Overall, I do not.
Okay. And how many from the U.S. team that you're involved with?
We have 6 members on our U.S. para-fencing team, 3 men and 3 women.
Okay. And I take it that, as with most other Olympic sports, there are separate men's and women's categories for the Paralympics?
Yes. And in our sport, there are 3 categories. Only 2 are represented at the Games. And it depends on the level of injury for those who have disabilities below the waist, like myself. I'm an above-the-knee amputee, but otherwise, you know, from spinal considerations, I'm intact. So in a wheelchair, there's not really anything that inhibits me from moving as much as possible from that apparatus, so I'm considered a Category A. A couple of my teammates have higher thoracic injuries, and they are considered Category B fencers since they can't move as aggressively in the chair.
Okay, and are there in one of the events, let's take Epe, will there be different Category A and Category B competitions?
Yes, okay. Men's Category A and men's Category B, women A, B, and then there will be a team event where the categories are combined.
Okay. And tell us a little about your journey. How did you find yourself participating in the Paralympics, and you know, how did you sort of have your the damage to your leg that led you to be eligible?
Well, I lost my leg in 2017. I was living in Los Angeles pursuing my master's degree at UCLA. I'm focusing on vocal performance. I was actually on my way to the final dress rehearsal of an opera that we were debuting in the United States. On my way to that dress rehearsal, somebody cut me off on the freeway, ended up being a four-vehicle accident. Mm. I spent months in the hospital recovering. But after 4 months of limb salvage attempts, unfortunately, we just had to be realistic about my functional abilities moving forward. And I decided to be the most functional and to avoid future injury, future complications, that it would be best to amputate my leg above the knee.
So, you know, your passions coming into this obviously were things like music. Did you have any background in fencing?
Not in fencing, but I'd always been a self-proclaimed gym rat. I was an amateur bodybuilder. I'd been in the military for 7 years at that point. So health, athletics, staying in shape and staying active, those were things that from a young age, my family, we were always up in the mountains. I'm from here originally in Salt Lake. And so staying active, staying fit, that was just part of who I was, and I wasn't going to let losing a leg stop me. I went back to work as a personal trainer. I'd already been doing it for a couple of years as my day job while going to school. I returned to that in Hollywood. And it was actually COVID that kind of redirected my path. I finished my degree and I came back to Salt Lake because work was really hard as a trainer and a singer in Los Angeles. Projectile sputum in both situations. So not a whole lot of work was available at the time, and an opportunity arose to come and join the clinical care team with the first prosthetic group that built my leg. Mm-hmm. So I jumped on the opportunity to reach out and help new amputees. My role is to go out and meet these new amputees a lot of times before their surgery. My goal is to try and demystify the process, provide information, and make it seem doable, because it is. But unfortunately, a lot of people feel very isolated mm-hmm. going through this. And it was through that I found fencing. My colleague, Mason, he is also an amputee, and he's become a great friend. The two of us together have created a wonderful program. We always joke, it can seem like such a little thing, but when you empower someone to take back control of their life after such a traumatic event, it's probably the most rewarding work I've ever done in my life to this point. And I've enjoyed it. And one of the days he came back and he had a medal around his neck. Mm. And I asked him what it was from, and he said he had been to a para-fencing competition in San Jose, when he invited me to come to practice. And I was like, maybe one day. And a couple months down the road, he'd asked maybe one or two more times. I just said, hey, when is your next practice? It sounds like fun. You seem to be having fun doing it. I'd love to come join you. And it was Veterans Day 2021 when I went to my first practice and met the coach there, Brandon Smith. I fell in love with it immediately. It was so different from the one experience I had had on a drill weekend where I showed up and a bunch of screaming children had taken over my armory. And we continued to train. I went to my first national event a couple of months later just to try and get my feet wet. I had no idea what to expect. And I ended up coming away with 2 bronze medals.
Wow.
A couple months later, we went to Charlotte for the 2022 Para-Fencing National Championships, and I swept bronze at that event. I started getting some attention from other fencers, the national coaches. I was invited to come out to a camp in Colorado Springs, and shortly after that, went to my first international event, the World Cup in Warsaw. Did not do so hot there. I definitely knew I was going to get my teeth kicked in just so I could get an idea of how fast I needed to get, because it is very much a speed sport, not a strength sport. And yeah, the rest has just been a roller coaster. I took a silver at our America's Zonal Championship. Our America's Zone actually includes all of North America, South America, and all of Africa. There just aren't enough sensors on those three continents to justify separating them. So brought home a silver in foil and continued to fence. Paris was always a long shot goal. It was that pie in the sky, if everything works out, kind of an ideal. And really the focus has always been on preparing for Los Angeles in 2028. But as we kept going and I started gaining more points, took a top 16 finish at one of the World Cups in Sabre. And most recently, I brought home a gold in Epe from our 2024 America's Zonal Championship. And everybody was as surprised as me. I went into that event not even thinking about Epe. I only brought my Epes because it was the last event of the competition. And prior to that, at a national level, I had swept gold in all three weapons. So I'm the current all-weapon national champion.
Garrett, for our listeners, and this is hard with radio, can we try to paint a picture of what it looks like, what fencing in the Paralympics looks like? Are the competitors in chairs?
Yes. Okay. It's a little bit deceptive because usually you think wheelchair, you think the chair is moving. In wheelchair fencing, we all have a wheelchair that we use. However, they are rolled up onto stationary frames.
Okay.
They are oriented based on your dominant hand. All of the gear is oriented based on your dominant hand. You have to buy gear specific to which hand you're going to handle your blade with for safety reasons. Mm-hmm. Those frames are then connected by a bar that has some adjustability to it because we want to set distance. Not everybody has the same length arms. So when we are setting distance, one person will hold their arms up kind of like a saguaro cactus, 90 at the shoulders, 90 at the elbows, and looking straight forward while the other person blindly holds their blade out towards the elbow. And a judge will come out and measure the distance. In Epe, the tip of the Epe must reach to your opponent's outer elbow. Mm-hmm. In foil and saber, the tip of the blade must reach the inner crook of your opponent's elbow. And they defer to the shorter person's preference. I have really long arms, so I rarely get to set distance.
Ah. Okay, and just for our listeners who are not familiar with fencing at all, what is the difference between the weapons, and does it affect the nature of the competition?
It does. So each weapon comes with its own set of gear and its own set of rules. Epee is probably the easiest for most people to jump right into and understand. It's the traditional fencing outfit that everybody pictures with white gear, typically a black mask, unless you're at the games and wearing your flag mask as approved by your national committee and the IOC. You have foil, where you have a vest that is reactive, and that is target. I didn't say this, but in FA, everything is target.
Okay.
And then you have saber, where the target is a metal reactive jacket. And the whole mask is a silver color because the whole mask is reactive as well. And in foil and saber, there are right-of-way rules. So the first person to begin their attack and move their hand forward is the person carrying the attack. So even if the other person hits, if there are two lights, the person with right-of-way or priority gets the point. And priority can change hands through a number of ways. If the person attacking falls short, or if your opponent parries, then right-of-way switches to the other side. So it can go back and forth quite quickly, And oftentimes people are very confused because they'll hear clack, 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 and then see two lights and they're like, well, I don't know whose it was, but the people up on the piece usually do, and so does the ref. And after a while, people who are familiar with fencing can watch from the stands and begin to understand why, even if there were two lights, one person's getting the point.
You know, as with any other sport, particularly when you're talking about this kind of travel, it's expensive. Are your fellow athletes and are you guys able to get sponsorships? How does the money work?
We are very fortunate here in Utah. We have a very generous sponsor in the Utah Fencing Foundation. It was started by a gentleman, Bill Nicolai, and he has helped multiple fencers to get started in the sport because there is a lot of gear and it is very specialized and it can be very expensive. He has made it possible for myself, 2021 Tokyo Olympian, Paralympian, Shelby Jensen Mitchell. We have other athletes who have benefited from it at a local level. We are trying to garner more sponsors going forward into the games. I would like to get to a point where I bring in enough sponsorship dollars from other sources that I can give back to the Utah Fencing Foundation and help other new fencers find a love of the sport as I have.
Well, Garrett Schoonover, we're looking forward to, we're wishing you success in Paris in the upcoming Paralympics. Good luck, and thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Roger. I appreciate your time.
Yesterday, the Utah Supreme Court issued a widely anticipated decision in Planned Parenthood Association versus State of Utah. As a result, a state law that effectively banned abortion in Utah will remain on hold, at least for the time being. On the phone to talk about the decision, its implication, and what comes next is Utah Planned Parenthood CEO Kat Boyd. Good morning, Kat. Thanks so much for joining us on what must be a busy day.
Good morning. Yes, I'm happy to be chatting with you. And yes, another very busy day.
Can you set the stage a bit by explaining about the law at issue and how the litigation got us to this point?
Oh, sure. So the law at issue is what is known as a trigger ban. So in 2022, when the Dobbs decision came out from the U.S. Supreme Court, the state of Utah, the legislators here already had passed a law that was just on hold until something like the fall of Roe v. Wade happened. So when that did happen, this trigger ban went into effect, essentially banning all abortions in the state of Utah with very, very limited exceptions to that law. So Planned Parenthood bounced back from that, and we filed a lawsuit against the state that this law essentially is unconstitutional per the Utah state constitution, and that it really compromised many of the rights that were guaranteed in that constitution. So as we filed that lawsuit, we have been going through the court process, and we were provided an injunction through the district courts. They felt that our case was legitimate and we had legitimate reasons for bringing this lawsuit, and they offered that injunction. So we've been able to provide care for these past 2 years since the fall of Roe v. Wade. The state decided that they wanted to bring a case to the Utah Supreme Court, essentially saying that injunction should not have been provided, that the law should have gone into effect regardless of our lawsuit. So they took it to the Utah Supreme Court for a decision on that. And that's where we're at today.
And that decision was pending for a while, wasn't it? How long ago was it argued?
Yeah, so we actually had oral arguments in front of the court on August 8th of last year. So just right, almost a year, we've been waiting for this decision.
Now, one of the advantages of talking to you as opposed to a lawyer is we're going to try to stay out of the weeds too much. But
yeah.
the sort of first point you made, and I want to make sure that we make it clear, the Dobbs decision concluded that under the U.S. Constitution, there was no protection of this right. This litigation focuses strictly on rights that arise from or are found in the Utah Constitution. Have I got that right?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. So I want to come back to a little bit of the reasoning of the court. It was a very long opinion that I almost managed to get through completely, but not quite. What are some of the implications? What would they be for Utah if that law had gone into effect in terms of... go ahead.
Yeah. What would happen is chaos. Chaos would ensue. Patients who seek care with us throughout the entire state and even from other states around us, like Idaho, would not be able to access abortion care here. So they would have to travel. It would, you know, not having this access or care available impacts the lives of so many people. It really would, like I said, it would cause chaos. Essentially, a woman's right to choose and have the ability to create the framework for when and if and how her family should look is out the door. You know, we're stripping that right away. And that was part of the basis for our lawsuit.
And, I've read in other states where there are relatively strict laws of this type, people have argued it has a significant chilling effect on the medical decisions made by OBGYN practitioners. Is that something that you can sort of explain a little bit?
Oh, yeah. You know, we've seen this over and over again in states that have abortion bans, and women come in to emergency rooms and they're having some kind of trauma. They're bleeding. They're worried that they may be losing the pregnancy. This is a wanted pregnancy. And those doctors they're scared to treat those patients. They're scared to use the training that they spent years and years in school to learn to take care of people. So they're sending people home with potential life-threatening conditions. So it's the impact across the country, and the impact to patients and to care providers has been devastating.
And without going into full lawyer nerd, I want to talk a little bit about what the issues that the Supreme Court dealt with and how they got to where they got. As I understand it, there were two real issues that the court grappled with. One was standing, and the other was sort of the underlying Utah constitutional provisions. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the standing issue and why the court got to where it did?
Sure. So I'm not an attorney, but as
you're lucky.
Yes, right. No, I chose this instead, right?
Yeah.
So as I understand it, the standing piece, and again, this decision was 4-1. So four justices felt very strongly that we did have standing to represent patients as well as our providers and staff that provide this care. We have standing to prove that this ban would cause harm. So that was the biggest piece. The other really big piece was the parts of the Constitution that we felt this law was trying to override, and that's the right to privacy, gender equality, the right for any person to decide on the makeup of their family, the right to personal bodily autonomy. There were like five different areas of the Utah Constitution that this ban breaches. And when we brought that forward, those justices agreed that we have standing. There was one justice that dissented. The other four very strongly said, yes, we do have standing. And then secondarily, that the finding was that this law does breach those constitutional rights.
I believe, first of all, with respect to standing, that issue is resolved. Okay, so no matter what happens when this case gets sent back down, that issue will not be raised again. As I understand it, and the underlying constitutional issues were not quite resolved. I think the issue they dealt with were serious questions about that presented. I think that was the standard they applied.
Yes.
But having said that, what your observation is, as they did the analysis, and by the way, the full nerd in me really thought the analysis was fascinating. There was a big section where they looked back to the history of the state of Utah and where things were at the time of the adoption of the Utah Constitution and statehood. And they focused on, among other things, a vibrant dialogue about how abortion was looked at by Mormon women at that time, including this big discussion about abortions prior to quickening. By the way, what is quickening?
Mm-hmm. Oh, so quickening is that the point in the pregnancy where the pregnant person can feel the flutters. Essentially, there's, you know, the movement of the fetus. So the pregnant woman can start to feel that, and it feels like flutters. Mm-hmm. That's the best way I can describe it. And so that's the point in the pregnancy, around 16 to 18 weeks, mm-hmm. where this starts to happen, and the person can really feel that pregnancy.
And again, this was a really, they spent a lot of time with this, obviously. I mean, this is a complicated,
right.
long decision that really, you know, look back to history and is actually actually worth reading. What happens now? I know it gets sent back to the lower court. Yeah. What will they decide?
Yes. So, you know, the timeline of this now is a little bit known, but mostly unknown. So right. the Supreme Court has to remand this case back to the lower court within 15 days. So that happens, that district court where we were where our arguments were initially heard, we pick back up where we left off. You know, so this has been just kind of in a stasis for this long period of time while this part was with the Supreme Court. So moving forward, as with any other case, you know, there are all of the different pieces. There will be lots of motions, discovery, all of those things that will happen in this process. And really, we do expect it's going to take months. This isn't going to be like, oh, okay, in 6 weeks, we're going to be back in the district court with a trial. Like, that's not what's going to happen. It's going to take a long time. So now we just continue down that road, doing what we're doing and continuing with this lawsuit.
And I'm sure that yesterday the lawyers were asked to read tea leaves as you were. How did they feel? How much of a signal do they feel that the Supreme Court sent about the viability of this constitutional protection theory in the Utah Constitution? Obviously, it goes back to the district court, but you can't. That decision, I think, is full of tea leaves as to where the Utah Supreme Court would ultimately come down.
You know, I would like to say, you know, my best hope is that, you know, this decision, first of all, it gives us some precedent. So this is a decision that will, I think, play largely in a very big way into our district court case, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What I would say about that is that the opinion of the court really, it gives me hope that they saw, you know, interestingly enough, too, I just want to point out that on the dissent, there was the Judge Durant only dissented on one piece, and that was the standing piece.
Right.
He didn't dissent on the constitutionality, right, of what we're bringing. So when you apply that now to this lawsuit and this case that will go forward, it really gives me hope that those justices saw this. They realize that as the Utah Constitution reads, those rights would be breached. And so moving that forward, it really rejuvenates my hope that we will prevail in this court case, because there have already been, you know, five folks that see that what we're bringing forward and how this ban will affect people goes against the basic rights that this state drafted for its citizens.
And those five people are pretty important five people.
Pretty important, yep.
We only have a little bit of time left. Let's talk about the reaction from the Utah legislature to this decision yesterday.
Yeah, well, they were disappointed is probably not even close to describing that. You know, I did hear some of the statements that came from some of our legislators and our governor, and, you know, I get it. They lost and they're upset, and, you know, they want to ban abortion care in this state 100%, right? That's their end goal. So my feeling is that we will likely see more legislation put forward, maybe a different ban. You know, they're upset, they're angry, they wanted to win, and they're going to continue their fight as well.
You know, it's interesting. I saw in the press yesterday reactions about additional legislation, and I don't quite understand how legislation can affect the underlying constitutional question. I mean, if it's in the Constitution, mm-hmm. it really doesn't matter what they pass, does it?
Right. Right. It's baffling. And also, you know, we've done a ton of research. We asked the question to just ordinary everyday citizens in the state, you know, what are their thoughts and feelings about abortion? And a majority of the folks feel that a pregnant person should have the right to choose. It may not be a choice they would make, but they don't want that choice taken away from other people. The other overwhelming thing, a piece that we see, is that citizens of this state want less government interference in their daily lives, not more. And what this ban is again trying to assert control over everyday people and how they live their lives.
Okay, it'd be interesting to talk more about how this fits into the larger picture of abortion rights around the country. But unfortunately, we are out of time. We've been talking with Kat Boyd, the CEO of Utah Planned Parenthood. Kat, what's the website if people want to learn more?
Sure. Just go to ppau.org, Planned Parenthood Association of Utah. You can pull up our C3 website and then our C4, which is our advocacy arm, and get more information from either of those places.
Kat, thanks for spending time with us. You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up Monday on Mountain Money, tune in. We're going to have author Adam Pearson talking about his new book, Finding Fortunato. And then we'll speak with Steve Brozovic, the president and CEO of the Utah Symphony. You've been listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW in Park City.